don't believe that we talked about God all the way. We also talked about her sex life. My name is Mildred Frank. I am from the Rocks Glen Traditional Group in Toronto. I am an alcoholic, and I'm very glad to be here. Good morning. Hi. What an incredible gathering this is. You know, in my wildest dreams, I could not have imagined being at an event like this and to look at the array of, well, I'll start with the speakers, because over the years, I have been with these gentlemen, first time with the sisters. I guess they don't mix the evil ones, as Bob says, with the good ones. I should make it clear I'm an excommunicated one. You know, and to look and to listen to all of you and to think back over the years, the times that we've had, I'm very grateful that you are my friends and that I have learned from you the things. I won't start to mention names because somebody will get left out and be hurt, but you're my heroes. And then all of you, some of my friends from Tennessee, Henry, glad to see you, Henry, and, you know, from Florida here. So it's wonderful to be here. And if you ever come to Toronto, do give me a phone call, because we'd love to welcome you. We have a discussion meeting, a closed discussion meeting on Monday nights, and we have an open speaker meeting. Tom has been there at the International and entertained us. We were up to the rafters and out on the park nearby because he filled us. Pardon?
Tell me about your stripping actor.
Later. It's coming. And Bob has been there. And Jerry's been, no, you haven't been to my group, have you? And Bob has been in town. So, anyway, I've been really obsessing about this thing, talking about fear and sex, ever since Lee told me. I forgot something. Lee, where are you? I want to thank you so much for inviting me to this event. And I want you to know how much I love you and respect you. It's wonderful to be here with you. And thanks to Robin for sharing her sex life with me. You know, on the farm, they used to have to prime the pump. And I think that her discussion primed my pump. I'm usually not nervous about this, but I really thought many, many times about what am I going to talk about. I'm in a real period of change. And whenever I'm in a period of growth and change, and it's a very good period, I always have to do a little extra reassessing. So I made some notes just to keep myself on track. Tell you just a little bit of who I am. Just take a few minutes to do that. I was born on a farm in Saskatchewan, and I can't ever remember feeling happy. The first memory I have is of somebody crawling into bed with me crying. It was my sister Dora, who was challenged, who had been injured at birth. And that really, I believe, formed my personality. It formed the way I thought about life. It formed the way I felt about life. You know, when I heard this morning there are all these people here under 30 days, all these people here under a year, and I thought, oh, my God, won't they be thrilled to hear what I have to say? That I'm really starting to change at almost 36 years of sobriety. It's taken all that time to get me where I am today, you know. God does his work as God does his work. I've done the best I can with what I was given. And this is what Bill Wilson says, and I love these talks. I love the letters of Bill Wilson, because that's where you really feel the man and how he really felt about life. And he said, I had some pretty heavy emotional shocks. There was deep family disturbance. I was physically awkward and the like. Other kids have such emotional handicaps and emerge unscathed. And I'm sure other kids have had emotional handicaps such as I did, and they went on with life, not I. I became a child of fear and anger and despair. I come from a big family, and I always thought those brothers and sisters loved me. And when Dora cried, I told them, you see, I'm just a few years older than 39, not many, but she was 16 and I was 3. And they had kept her in grade 3 till she was 16 years old. And she used to cry at night. And I made it my business to stop that crying. And I went to those brothers and sisters who I believed loved me and said, you've got to fix this. And they didn't. I thought it was because they didn't love me. I thought it was because I wasn't important. I thought that was my basis for being, well, no, I didn't think. It was my basis for becoming so angry and despairing. I tried God. We were Roman Catholic. I told God, because the priest said God was love and God was power. And I remember thinking, there's my answer. All I have to do is tell God as if God didn't know, and I'll give him his marching orders and everything will be fine. And, you know, that didn't happen either. And I became confused and I began to look on God. Yeah, I believe you're there, but you're a useless twit. What use are you if you got a problem like I have and you don't fix it and you've got the power? You see, I just didn't understand life. And then at 5, I took a drink, and by God, I needed one. I come from a family in which there was alcoholism. I took that drink and I knew there was a God, and it came out of a bottle. And for the next 35 years, that was my preoccupation. Where's the booze? Who has it? What am I going to have to do? Is there enough? Etc., etc., etc. And of course, you understand, if you understand what the book says, that drinking alcohol is only the symptom. I was a sick puppy a long time before I ever took the drink, and it wasn't the alcohol that created that. I believe I was an instant alcoholic. And, of course, at 5 years old, you drink different than you do at 35. But nevertheless, that was my preoccupation. How am I going to get my father's home brew? How am I going to get it, and how am I going to hide the fact that I'm taking it, and so on and so on. At 18, I decided to go to a convent. Not smart if you're an alcoholic to start with. I was drunk the night I entered there, and they took me anyway, which probably says as much about them as it does about me. I stayed there for 15 years, drunk a lot of the time. In January of 1966, by a series of circumstances, it was decided that we get my dispensation, and I came out. And for me, that was the beginning of an emotional landslide, such as I had never experienced. I needed to drink. I found the booze. I found the booze in the bars. I found the men in the bars. And I don't have to tell you what the next 10 months were like. In 3 weeks, I was in jail. Me! At the end of that time, I signed myself into an insane asylum, because that's how I saw myself. There's something really wrong with me. And it was from there my brother took me to Saskatoon, and there I was to meet Dr. Hoffer. And if you know the history of our organization, you know that Dr. Hoffer was doing experiments with LSD, and Bill Wilson had consulted him. And so Dr. Hoffer knew about LSD. He knew about Bill Wilson and AA. He went to my psychiatrist and said, this girl is an alcoholic. He said, you know, because by that time I had been locked up 32 times in mental institutions, psych wards, and insane asylums. I had been diagnosed with every mental illness on the book, and I had had 38 electroshock treatments. And if you need your life lit up, that will do it. I have to tell you, I also married my psychiatrist. I don't know why you find that so amusing. Maybe you need psychoanalysis. Anyway, I went to AA. My father said you get transformed here. My brother, who was dying, went to AA. As it turned out, he was 49 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous when he died. But at the time, my father called me and he said, your brother went to AA. It's so good. And he cried and he said, your brother has been transformed. Well, I like that. I'd like to be transformed. So I came to AA and sat there waiting to be transformed. My pleasure in AA lasted about 3 weeks. And then all those causes and conditions that were so rife within my life took hold. And I just didn't know what to do. Now, I'd been introduced to things that alter your perceptions in other ways. So I sat in AA 5.5 years stoned. And I don't recommend that. And at the end of that time, I left Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went out to drink again. They say it's a progressive disease, and it's a fatal disease. And by this time, I was having convulsions. I've had 6 convulsions, and I couldn't stop drinking. I was having blackouts, and I was having blankouts, and winding up in very strange places. And eventually, my husband, too, was an alcoholic, and he had started to drink as well. And we lost everything, and I wound up on a park bench with everything I owned in a little suitcase and a plastic bag. And I can tell you, in my wildest dreams, I could never have imagined that that would happen to me. I come from a family of integrity. I spent 15 years in a convent, going to university, studying theology, studying all kinds of stuff. And here I am on a park bench selling my body for a bottle of booze. Not really an auspicious ending, is it? And it was there on May the 20th that I had a spiritual experience. My dry date is May the 18th, 1973. And for that, I'm grateful. I was in that, the police picked me up and put me in the psych ward. And on Sunday morning, I had a spiritual experience. I took stock of my life, and I decided this is the end. I can't do this anymore, and I decided to take my life. And I asked the nurse to get my clothes, and she went to get my clothes. And in a heartbeat, I had a spiritual experience. That's all I can call it, because it was as if a hand reached into me and took the compulsion and the obsession. And in almost 36 years, I've never had it back. It was gone. And I knew it was gone, and I knew that I didn't have to drink again. But I also knew something, and that was that I didn't know how to live, which is what brings me right to this fear. I remember saying, whatever you are, however this has happened, I don't know how to live. You'll have to send me somebody, and there was a rap at the door. Honest to God, that's exactly what happened on May the 20th. And there was a man there who said, I saw you at breakfast, and he offered me help, and he took me to the treatment center hospital started by Dr. Bell. And that's where my life, that's where life really began. The book says that fear somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. I think, as I have tried to tell you just a sketch of the things that happened to me, you can see there was a very afraid person operating in there. It says the fear was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. And so it was in my life. And the interesting thing was, I never identified myself as fearful. I identified myself as depressed. I identified myself as angry, but fearful, somehow or other, that word just And yet there it is. Carl Jung says, and again, I'm going to this article that Bill wrote. Carl Jung said this: any person who has reached 40 years of age and who still has no means of comprehending who he is, where he is, and where he is next going cannot avoid becoming a neurotic to some degree or other. Me? This is true whether his youthful desires for sex, material security, and a place in society have been satisfied or not. And that's the end of his quote. And then Bill says, when the benign doctor said becoming neurotic, he might just as well have said becoming fear-ridden. So, note what he says. If you can't see who you are, where you are, and where you're going, that's all you can become. He gives us 40 years, and that's exactly how old I was. And I did not know who I was. I did not know where I was going, and I certainly didn't know what was coming next. And I think that what was wrong with me, and I'm saying this, I didn't always see this, was a case of mistaken identity. See, if I went to New York and I went to Neiman Marcus, and then I went to Los Angeles, and I went to Saks Fifth Avenue, and I went to Nordstrom's in Minneapolis, and bought all kinds of things, and said, I'm Mrs. Bob Bazans. Just send the bill to Mr. Bazans. Do you think that I'd be comfortable coming here to Florida, knowing that Bob was here? I might be just a touch anxious. Or suppose that I went around the planet saying, I'm Queen Elizabeth. It's not true. It's not who I am. And if that's the identity that I'm trying to function under, I really get this. I was trying to function under an identity that I am not. See, I didn't know that. My illusions were these. I'm just a human being. Anybody ever said that? What do you want from me? I'm just a human being. I had the idea that the body of me was the important piece. I was totally dependent on people, situations, and things. I believed that you were the problem, absolutely. And that if I could just manipulate and control the outside the way I thought it should be, according to my specifications, I'd be fine. See, Chuck Chamberlain used to come out to Prince Albert. And Chuck used to sit me down. These were the days when I was going to meetings stoned. And Chuck would sit me down, and he would draw that circle that you see in the book, New Pair of Glasses. And he'd say, this is your problem, Mildred. He'd say, you think you're separate. You think you're different. And then he'd draw that dark line and then that little stick figure, and he'd say, that's your false self. That's your ego. That's the problem. You think you don't belong in that circle. And I believe that today. I am in the circle. I belong in the circle. And no matter what it is that this false self has me do, because I think I'm not okay, nobody loves me, I'm not important, etc., 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 then I start to feel wrong. I start to feel different. I start to feel all kinds of things. I get it today. That's what Chuck was trying to tell me. Look what Einstein said, and Bob quoted him yesterday. He said it's an optical delusion to believe that there are many of us here, several hundred people. He said there's only one of us here. And thank you, Bob, for that reminding us of that Hindu story of, you know, that God decided to put some of himself in each one of us and then set us here to play this game. And I'm not implying that life is a game, but I think that this interaction that we do with each other, I think the big deal is to come to that place where I can see You are not your body. I am not my body. I live in this spacesuit. And one of these days, I'm going to unzip it, or God's going to unzip it, or what? And I'm going somewhere else. And the deal, I think, in life is to try and see and to see the God in you and to know you're just dancing in your spacesuit. You're dancing in this body. And that, to me, has brought me a whole different way of life. See, I love the book. The book speaks the truth to me. And I don't know where they hide some of these things. But sometimes I take that book and I say, I never saw that before. As a matter of fact, the odd time somebody will send me a quote and I think to myself, that's not in the book. And then I go look and you bet it's there. The book says alcohol is the symptom. My mother didn't know that. She thought drinking, the way I drank was the problem. But the way I drank was the solution because I wasn't dealing with what the real problem was, that feeling of being different, that need I had to make the outside the way I thought it should be. And so, if you don't understand that, you're going to be like I was, paralyzed. And the step three says the root of the problem is what? That little stick figure, the selfishness, the self-centeredness that expects I should be at the middle of the piece. You know, I've never yet gotten up in the morning and somebody phoned me and said, you know, Mildred, you're in the middle of my life. How would you like me to behave today? So, you know, I think that my problem really is and still is today, falling asleep. Falling asleep, not in the body, but falling asleep in the spirit. And going back to that old idea that says you should be different, and if you did things different, then I'd be okay. You know, that's when I start to feel a hole in my soul, and there isn't any. Because if God is there, there's no hole in the soul. I've been reading a lot of Joel Goldsmith lately. And, you know, he says, you think, he says, that you decide how you're going to express God. He said, God decides how God is going to express. You know, so if I had a rose here, we could see that. God has decided how to express his beauty. We can think of the mountains. God has decided how to express his magnificence. The ocean is right here. God has decided how to show us the majesty and all of that that is his life. And in the lowly cockroach, we see that as well, the life that God is. And so I've come to believe that we are really God beings in disguise. And, you know, if you go to a party, in a disguise, you know you're just wearing the disguise for a little while, and then you're going to take that disguise off and the real you comes out, you see? So what does the book say? Well, on page 50, you know, and I didn't always, and I read these things, and it didn't all come together for me. It says, we have gained access to a power greater than ourselves. On page 53, it says, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or God is nothing. And one day it hit me. You want to go through life saying God is nothing? And I said, okay, I'll say you're everything, God. I don't understand it. See, this isn't stuff that the intellect understands. You know, some of us, we think we're so smart and our intellect, you know, is going to carry us places and it carries us to do things for the body. But this is heart stuff. This is the stuff of the soul. And how does it get from the head to the heart? Through action, through being here, through service, through being with one another. On page 55, he says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Wow! And on page 55, it says, We found the great reality with capital G and capital R deep within us. And then to finish off the first 164 pages, he says, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and then great things will come to pass for you and countless others. It doesn't say today. However, I think I've come to believe that the great thing is really to be here, to be part of. And this is where you come into my life, Sandy. I was listening to one of your tapes about 15, 12 years ago, maybe. And in that tape, Sandy said, we come here in a two-in-one package, the body and the spirit. And my spirit stood up and I said, yeah, that's it. Because I still had those ideas, perhaps, of a God out there, not a God within me that is waiting. You know, and I had read the prayer of St. Francis how many times, and what does it say? Let me bring light where there's darkness. Let me bring faith where there's doubt, etc. Well, if I'm going to bring it and if I'm going to be a channel for it, it's got to be within me. And that was the piece that started me on that path. What does the third step prayer say? It says, God, I offer myself to you. I'm going to do what you want me to today. I'm going to be your feet. I'm going to be your hands. I'm going to be your mouthpiece. And whatever it is that you put in my life today, the people that you put in my life, the situation that I have to deal with, that's what I'm going to deal with as you would have me do it. You know, it seems to me, ideas are easy to take in. You know, I've sat at things, I've heard speakers, I've read books, I've studied a lot of things, and ideas are easy to take in. That's why I think for it to go from the head to the heart, that's the big deal. You know, and that's why if you go home and you say, I heard this and I heard that and I heard the other thing at this Woodstock, and then you go back and do your old ways, don't be surprised. And don't beat on yourself. God is still within you. And God still loves you. And as Sandy says, he loves you when you're sinning. See, I heard that too. Change takes a lot of living. It takes a lot of everything that life is for. And that's why I think it's so important not to shy away from life and to run away. It's important to be engaged. And you know that you'll make mistakes and you know that you'll have your triumphs both on the outside and the inside. And it all goes because it's not we who grow our souls. It's God who grows our souls, you see. Meister Eckhart, a 13th century mystic, put it this way. He said, the soul grows by subtraction. And Carl Jung, again, he said this, spiritual experience is not enough. We must find a spiritual community in which we can try to practice what that spiritual experience was all about. You know, I just love Bill Wilson. I think if there's anybody in our program that I really identify, I love that he was depressed for 15 years. That really turns me on. I get that. You know, when I hear some of the stories of stuff that went on in their lives, I get that. And he doesn't go down in my estimation. But he goes up in my estimation because he had the courage to keep on. I was at Stepping Stones a couple of months ago, and the manager there had pulled out some letters. And one of these letters was a letter Bill had written in 19... Because I used to kind of feel as I went through my AA life, I should be happier. There's something wrong with me. Whatever. That Tom there, he's got it easy. And Bob, he's beyond the pale, so we don't worry about him. And so it goes. And I used to look at the lives of other people, and you too, and think, he's far too happy and peaceful. I can't. How did I get on this topic? Yeah, thanks. And in that letter, he wrote it in 1956 to a woman who had just lost her husband, and he was commiserating with her. And he said in that letter, "I used to think that happiness was the goal of living." And he said, "I no longer believe that." He said, "Of course we're going to have times in life that are easier than others." But he said, "I believe today that the goal of living is spiritual awakening." Well, he had written that in 1938 or whenever, but now he was acknowledging that's what he believed, and he went on to discuss that. The one thing that I have done right is I've always stayed here since 1973. I have never had a period where I've said, this doesn't work. I've thought it, you know, sometimes it works for you and it doesn't work for me. But I also know there's no place to go. This is it for me. This is my spiritual way. This is my spiritual community. And through the recovery and service and unity, you know, I'm really starting to feel that. You know, I hear young people people say, "Oh, I came in, you know," and we have this slogan on the wall, "You're no longer alone." I walked in and I just knew I was no longer alone. And I think, well, bully for you. I've sat at meetings many a time and felt isolated and different and God knows what, and wondered, why do you look so good and I feel so miserable? And of course, I'm judging your outsides by my insides. Never works. At 21 years of being sober, I had a crisis in my life, and it was at that time that I learned to meditate regularly. It was at that time, no, I guess I had done this for a long time before, to read spiritual literature. What I think is interesting now, I've talked about this, and a bunch of the young guys at my group, guess what we do on Sunday mornings? They asked if they could come to my house. And so on Sunday mornings, they come and we read spiritual literature together by their choice. I'm very excited about this, to see that kind of energy abroad. And I started at that time to practice the presence of God seriously. Father Thomas Keating, he puts it this way. He says, "The universe has an agenda. Whatever is helpful for the process of waking up will appear." No place to run from it. It will appear. If it's good for my waking up process, it will appear. Whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, I can be sure it is always purposeful. And you know, in that article that Bill wrote on emotional sobriety, he talks in there how to translate a right mental attitude into a right emotional result. Think about this. I can think about this. The meetings I've gone to, you know, the retreats I have attended, the retreats I have given, the books I've read, etc., etc. And sometimes this question comes up, how to translate a right mental attitude into a right emotional result. You know what? You keep doing the next right thing. And you keep letting this process percolate and grow you. And you try not to beat on yourself because you're doing the best you can. I've done some horrible things in my life, and you know what? Every time. I was doing the best I knew how, the best according to what I could see at that time. And if that's the case with me, why is it not the case with you? You see? So, yes, I grew. But, you know, I also came in with the attitude I know about God. And I'll tell you, it has taken a lot of stripping. And the final piece of this was, about 8 years ago, I got involved in a business situation as a volunteer. And that has evolved into legal matters, and so I won't say any more about it, except to say this. At that point, I experienced a level of fear that I couldn't even have imagined. And I used to sit there. I kept doing my spiritual work. And I think it's Carl Jung talks about the transforming fires. I used to sit there doing my meditation, and my heart would pound, and I'd think, am I going to have a heart attack today or tomorrow? And some of my friends who were privy to what was going on would say, why don't you resign? Why don't you get out of there? But I knew the problem was not out there. The problem was in here. And I was big enough and tough enough to sit with it in the grace of God. And I have to tell you that that has evolved in me to an absolutely beautiful place. I'll just say a few things before we get to the sex part. Thanks, Lee. Bill says we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. We asked ourselves why we had them. And wasn't it because self-reliance failed? See, if I'm going around the planet announcing that I'm Mrs. Bob Bazans, it doesn't matter how big my mask is. It doesn't matter how much self-confidence I operate. I'm going down one way or the other. And so he says, wasn't it because self-reliance failed? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough, you see. If I try to do something like this based on my smarts, I'm in trouble. I can tell you right now, I won't do it. I've got to rely on the power that is within me and be willing to suit up and show up, whether you like me, agree with me, or not. Meister Eckhart, that's why he said, the soul grows by subtraction. This is God's work in us. And he goes on to say, there's a better way, we think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. You know, those are just words until the rubber hits the road. Those are just words until your head is in the vise. They're just words to me until I am sitting there and my heart is pounding and I'm telling myself all kinds of stuff. The basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. And just to the extent that we do that, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? So I made the deal with God. I'm going to sit here, and I'm going to do this job, and I'll do it as long as I have to until I experience peace. And that is precisely what has happened. So what is the role I'm here to play? I don't think it's about giving retreats. And I don't think it's about being a member of AA, and I don't think it's about being a daughter, and I don't think it's any of that external stuff. I believe that if that is true, you know that story Bob told about the God putting himself in each one of us, then that's the role I'm to play. I am to do the good that God would have me do. I am to see the God in you and to treat you accordingly. Whether I like you or not is irrelevant, because love isn't about like. Love is about a decision to see the world different. And then he goes on to say, we never apologize for God. It is the way of strength. And I have to tell you, if you knew me way back when, you would understand what I'm saying. There is no way that I went from there to this podium. And it's not being at the podium, but the kind of person that I am today, the way I see the world. And Tom, I remember you saying that you had not managed that process and that the things that you had decided to do, they all went up in smoke. And the things that you didn't decide to do, you saw that there was a power guiding. You know, one time I went to see somebody and in Winnipeg, and he said, "I want you to read this book." And I said, "I don't like that author." So he said, "Fine." So the next day, I went back to Aurora, which is where I was living at the time, and I had to pick up some books at a bookstore. And the bookshelves were lined up straight, honest to God. There must have been 6 or 7 of them, hundreds of books, and all the books were upright, and there was one sticking out. And I saw it, and I said to myself, "It couldn't be." You go tell me how that kind of stuff happens. You tell me there's no universe guiding and showing us. We let him demonstrate through us what he can do. I don't think the ocean needs to say, "Look at me, look how wonderful I am." You see? And I don't need to, and that's why we have that spiritual anonymity, because anything that happens here and anything that happens in our life is, you know, God at work. And so he says, we let him demonstrate through us. You know, there's no magic wand given to you, and I don't think God has a magic wand. God waits for me to exercise my magic wand, and my magic wand has one word written on it: yes. And when I say yes, the universe says yes, and then all things are possible. And now we're going to talk about sex. Are you applauding me, or are you glad we're going to talk about sex? Well, I'm going to start with what Bill says in that part. He says, we do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. Just remember that. I've thought long about this. How can I say what I really want to say? You know, so I'm going to try and do this and be appropriate and yet tell the truth. You can read the book. The book tells us, you know, we look at our sex conduct, et cetera, et cetera. I believe today that the body is a gift. I believe that being on the planet in this body is a gift. And I believe that being a sexual being is a gift. It's part of who I am. This imperious urge gives me an opportunity to make choices, re the growth of my soul. It's how I express myself on the planet. My first inventory, two guys took me through the book because my first sponsor had gotten drunk. And when we got to the sex part, I thought, well, and I think I said it, I don't have much there. There's nothing much. I was in a convent for 15 years. And I started to write. Pages. I had been a busy little girl. Yeah. We're just starting. And I realized that my sexual identity has played a big role in how I have done life. As a little girl, I heard whispering. And it was not the kind of whispering that people did about other stuff. I always knew when there was a certain type of whispering, it was about something. And my interpretation at that time would have been, it's something dirty. That's what they're talking about, this man-woman stuff. I also realized very early that there were two sets of attitudes. There was the family attitude toward the boys and what they did, and there was the family attitude toward girls and how girls were supposed to behave, and I didn't like it. And then came puberty, and I realized I was deeply ashamed of my body, and I really didn't know why. I never talked to anybody about it, and nobody ever talked to me about it. And so that kind of thinking helped to form who I was and how I saw myself. Now, if the sex instinct is God-given, and it is through that instinct that I am to express myself, the attitudes I had, you can see, were very unhealthy. I also absorbed the lessons of sexuality. I learned that it matters whether you come onto the planet in the body of a boy or you come onto the planet in the body of a girl, because it's going to define certain things. So, who I am as a sexual being was influenced by my social conditioning. And this is what I saw. I believed that men were the boss, men were the leaders, men were the power brokers in business, politics, finance, and I just assumed it was the same in sexual activities, even though I'm sure I didn't know that I had assumed that. Men took the dominant role, and women did what was needed to be of service. They cooked and they cleaned and they mended and they made the garden and they had the babies and all that stuff. That's what I saw at home. That's what I read in the novels that I read. That's what I studied at university, or that those were the attitudes that I had. And fellas, I don't think you're brutes. And I love you, all of you. I keep taking resumes, as a matter of fact. It was just the way things were. And I didn't like the way things were. I went to the convent very innocent, quite innocent. I came out of the convent innocent, inexperienced to an extent, but full of questions, full of questions. And then January the 10th, 1966, I was dispensed from my vows, had played around with them a little bit anyway. I no longer wore the long black gown, and I no longer had to keep the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and all bets were off. I needed to drink, and I found the booze down at the bars, and I found the men, and it was only 3 weeks, and I was in jail, and I'm not going to go into more detail than that. You can figure that all out yourself. You see, I think the imperious urge is part of our experience, just like the urge to eat food, just like the urge to walk, the urge to do sleep, to do a lot of things. I can use it or I can abuse it. And you see, I think when that imperious urge gets mixed up with other things, that's where the trouble erupts. I feel like a nothing. I'm out of the convent. I don't know where I fit. I never did know where I fit. I never did feel okay. I never would let people love me. So now, here I am. I'm down at the bars. And so I used my body to get what I wanted. I used my body to feel loved. I used my body to go places. You see, my sexual promiscuity was very much attached to how I saw myself. And I would venture to say that that's a pretty clear statement of the way a lot of people do this kind of thing. You see, I saw myself as a loser and unimportant and unloved and unable to succeed. That's the way I felt about myself. So sex got mixed up with my position in society. It got mixed up with finances. It got mixed up with my emotional well-being, and it was all about me. And I can tell you, I made some bargains that were absolutely hideous. I need you for recognition and prestige. I need you because you're more popular than I am. You're more worldly than I am, and I, in return, will give you sex. Not a pretty picture, but I, you know, as I look at it today, I'm grateful that I had this experience, because it has allowed me to clear. Somebody sent me an article, a little paragraph the other day from Everyday Wisdom, a little book. Love making can and should be a joyful act, an act of surrender to the divine in yourself and in your partner. Physical love is no less beautiful than other forms of love, nor can it be separated from them. If you view physical love as unholy, you will probably experience it that way, not because it is, but because you perceive it that way. I think it's such a pity to grow up thinking that sex is dirty. Anyway, that's not to blame anybody. You know, that's maybe another area of growth that we as a race have to take on. The only concern was for me how someone affected me. I had no concern for the rampage that I brought into your lives. I had no concern for what, you know, my mother, you know, coming home with the family banker at 7 o'clock in the morning. He's a married man with 3 children. It didn't concern me that she might be somewhat horrified by that kind of behavior. See, this is all wrong. This is all out of harmony. And so I lived in shame. I lived in dishonesty. I lived in degradation and really didn't get it. In 1966, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous didn't stop me. It just provided a wider... You know, I was in Prince Albert at the time, and Cease could tell you many stories. But I have to really pay tribute to Cease. He never once took me to task. He talked to me about, you know, other things, and he certainly talked to me about honesty and so on. But he followed this. He let me know that my behavior was out of line. But I think he also really, I never felt judged and I never felt put down. In 1972, I married that psychiatrist, and that didn't stop me either. We married in 1972 and divorced in 1974. Not a great testimony to marriage. My brothers and sisters, they're all married 60, 65 years. That'll give you an inferiority complex, I'll tell you. Then on May the 20th, 1973, I had that spiritual experience. Bill says in the 12 and 12, in step 10, we come here and we have loved but a few. We are indifferent to the many so long as they cause us no problems. And the rest we really disliked or hated. Sandy, you were the one who drew my attention to that too. My only difference with my, that describes me, except I hated everybody. Everybody was wrong. Everybody had done me in. Nobody had been willing to fix my life. I hated myself, and that's what I brought here. You know, then when I tell you about all this sexual stuff, you know, that doesn't bode well for sexual activity, does it? To be doing that kind of stuff out of that kind of hatred. So once I came into the program in 1973, you know, as Tom said yesterday, we start to clean up some of that stuff. And I did. And, you know, I've had two more relationships in sobriety. But I bring me to a relationship. I love being infatuated, don't you? I'd be infatuated 365 days of the year if I could get away with it. I love it. The problem is, see, Freud it was who said, when we're infatuated, that's how the universe gets us together. And we produce a hormone, and it's epi-something. And he said, we get 90 days of socially acceptable insanity. Yeah. And then the real work starts. And the real work with the first relationship, he couldn't stay sober. I'm sober by that time 3 years. Well, you are going to get sober. So one day I find him, he's lying on my bed, and I'm determined he's going to pray. He said, I don't want to pray. He said, I want beer. And I said, no, you pray. He said, no, I want beer. And I grabbed his ears, and I pounded his head on the bed, and I said, you pray, you son of a bitch. I was sure, you know, talk about having our hooks in people. He was going to be the next president of a big company, and I was going to be the wife of the president. So I got to get this so-and-so sober. And, of course, I was sure he was going to die without me. And then things just got worse and worse, and finally we broke up that relationship. And you know what happened? Without me, 6 months later, he was sober. And he had 16 years of wonderful sobriety before he died. Without me. Don't get it. Jeez. And then I eventually had another relationship, and that lasted 15 years. Unfortunately, we both left it after two. I was still behind my walls. He was behind his walls. And, you know, after a while, when we got done talking about the weather and a few external things, we had nothing more to say to each other. And eventually sex doesn't survive that kind of thing, and neither does any kind of feeling you've ever had for one another. It's sad, but I'm glad I had the experience, because when that relationship broke up, then it was growing time. I was 21 years sober at that time. And that's when the work started. That's when I was ready. You know, and talk about God directing your life. I had also left my teaching job, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I had not planned for my retirement, so to speak. And I thought about Tom, because 3 weeks after this, the phone rang. And it was Father O'Brien, the Jesuit. I didn't know Father O'Brien. And he said, Mildred, I've heard about you. He said, I'd like you to come and give a retreat. And I said, Father, you don't know about me. I said, I've been excommunicated so many times. And he said, I don't care about that. And that started a whole new life for me. It had never crossed the radar that I should give retreats. Well, anyway, I'm off the track. But that's when the real work began. That's when I seriously started to meditate twice a day. That's when I seriously started to do the spiritual reading and the practicing the presence of God. And I don't have time, but I can tell you this. The walls came down. I think one of the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous is, to me, is I'm no longer a hard person. I no longer sit among you and feel I don't care for you. I no longer go through the motions with people and just feel, well, you know, I got to talk to this one. I really care about you because I care about myself. See, that's the business of recovery and service and unity. And that's where we help one another. You know, AA doesn't keep me sober. But what AA does is it provides the vehicle for God's grace to come to us and to change us. See, so Bill says, where have we been selfish? And he gives us that list of questions. The only one I never did, I never bothered arousing jealousy. I just looked for the next guy. I never bothered arousing suspicion or bitterness. But what I do want to comment, I don't think because you go out and get laid that you're going to get drunk. And I don't think Bill Wilson does either. You know, I'm bad. When these young guys, there are about 10 of them now who come and the numbers get bigger. And when we first started, they were looking at me kind of cross-eyed, and I said, don't think that if we do spiritual reading, you'll never get laid again. And I think the air went out of them collectively. But what he does talk about is the right ideal. You know, I think just as it's important to look at the mistakes, I think it's also important to look at the right ideal. And, you know, I love that article that somebody sent me, just kind of didn't know what I was up to these days and just sent this to me. You know, that lovemaking should be a joyful act, an act of surrender to the divine in yourself and your partner. I'll sum it up by saying I used people. I used people so I could feel good. I used people so I could look good. I used people because I was afraid to be alone. I used people because I felt depressed. That, I think, is the ultimate wrongdoing, to use people in that way. And I never want to do that again. And so God has sent somebody very nice into my life. I've never experienced this before, to be able to say to somebody, I really care about you and know that I really do care about that person, and not need anything from them, not have to control them in any way, and to hear him say, and I really care about you. Those are the gifts that make this work worthwhile. And if you haven't experienced that, keep coming because it's fabulous. God bless you.